From the Marquee Media Studio inside Mark Tank, it's the Mark Haney Show.
And now it is my pleasure to bring on Joe D'Annunzio and Andrew Hargadin. They are with UC Davis, and I'll let them give a little bit of their background because these guys have an incredible background. But what we have in common is that we believe in the power of entrepreneurship and innovation and what it can do for our society. And UC Davis really is a gem within the Sacramento region and even worldwide. They're making such an impact with the innovations that are coming out of there. So we're going to talk a little bit about that today. But before that, Joe, why don't we start out with you, a little bit of your extensive background, and maybe Sure. Give us what you're most proud of that background as well, because now you're at UC Davis, which you're part of my hometown.
Boy, that's a tough question, Mark. I don't even know if that's fair, but all right. So I'm going to give the 90-second version of my background. So actually, my degree as an undergrad is in developmental psychology, and I joke all the time that what I learned in two-year-old lab, is the single most important thing that has enabled me to be successful in a business career. If you know how to manage two-year-olds, you're good in the corporate boardroom. But I've had a career in business, the first two-thirds of my career in large companies like Procter & Gamble and Disney, and then in startups. And I've been involved in probably 25 or 30 startups as either an executive, a board member, or an investor, and have really sort of mid-career caught the entrepreneurial bug. And then we moved here to this region for my wife to go to vet school. And we thought it was going to be a four-year sort of, you know, move up from L.A. And we have absolutely loved this region. We've been here 21 years now. And she's on faculty of the vet school. And so I took a faculty position as an adjunct at the Graduate School of Management at UC Davis. And then met Andy and started working at the Institute for Innovation and Entrepreneurship. And I know we're going to talk a fair bit about it. But I will say one thing, you know, say what we're most proud of. I think the thing I like the most about working at the Institute is we're able to work with students across the spectrum of all 10 colleges and schools at UC Davis that all have an aspiration to have an impact on the world, but all very different. Some of them want to start companies in their garages, right? Some of them want to go work for big companies like Intel and invent the next generation of technologies. Some of them want to promote social change or policy change, right? And the benefit of the Institute is we can serve all of those students, the principals, and a lot of the work that Andy's done as a researcher in innovation and entrepreneurship apply wherever you want to be a change maker, right? And so we can talk about that as we are going. But that's the thing I think I'm most excited. I see our students going into government. I see them starting companies in technology, in food and agriculture, and, you know, joining social movements as well. And these are all, you know, really rewarding to see.
Exciting stuff. Andy, why don't you I'll give you the same question. Background and something you're most proud of. And how'd you end up at UC Davis?
That's a long story. So I started out as an engineer, undergrad. Actually, I started out technically as an econ major. And then about 2.5 years in, I wandered into the engineering student design lab and walked out a product design major. So I did product design undergrad, and then I went out and worked for a little bit, then came back, did a master's in product design, and then ended up at Apple doing the early laptops. So if you remember the first laptops that came out, you know, I've got parts in there, I've got parts on the supplies, and I had a absolute blast drinking from a fire hose during those years.
When you were with Apple, how many employees were there at that time?
So this was in the early 90s.
Okay.
So it was already big and had shrunk and was going to shrink more before it would get big again.
Okay. So most proud more of the background?
So I finished at Apple realizing that I really did enjoy the teaching of design and innovation. And so I went back and finished a PhD out of the Industrial Engineering Group, which was the best place to study engineering and design innovation. And with that, ended up becoming a professor. And it turns out that business schools are the place to be a professor of innovation. And so that's where I ended up at Davis.
All right.
And you asked me why Davis, and I can tell you flat out, I grew up in Palo Alto in the 70s, and Davis in the 2000s was Palo Alto in the 70s.
Interesting.
Small town, nice restaurants, but you could still park, you know, nice houses, but you could still buy one.
Right.
You know, all of that great stuff, plus a research university doing amazing things. And and so that's what really drew me there.
Yeah. And what's your proudest career moment?
Huh. Yeah, going back a lot, I mean, I think apropos to today's conversation, at least, because we could have many of those, is the what I've really enjoyed the most is when we started to teach scientists and engineering PhDs and postdocs. You know, I mean, I love MBAs. They're a great group of people to teach, and they're going to go out and make, you know, a big difference in the world. But there's something about giving entrepreneurship exposure to science and engineering PhDs, mm-hmm. researchers who are on the bench. They've probably spent the last 4 or 5 years on the bench, giving them a sense of what they can do to move their ideas out or to make sure that the ideas they're developing will have a home somewhere.
Okay. Well, can you elaborate on that? Give me an example of how that has happened and maybe so we can get kind of your arms around that.
So at the Institute, one of our first programs that we created was we started out, I brought two other people together to help me teach an entrepreneurship class at the business school. That was Charlie Soderquist, who was a former UC Davis faculty and a local investor, angel investor. And then Scott Linette, who was at DFJ Frontier. He was a venture capitalist. He now runs Touchdown Ventures, another venture capital program. And we created a course that we were going to teach to the MBAs. And I had one stipulation, which was we were going to teach it like a design program taught. In a design program, they ask you to design a chair. And you're one of 25 students. You pull a couple all-nighters, you design a chair, you build it, you paint it, you do everything about it, you put it on stage, and it sits up next to all the other chairs. And then the judges come along and they look at it and they sit in it and all that stuff. And it, you know, it's one of those goals that, you know, it breaks, it doesn't break, it's comfortable, it's not comfortable. And there's no denying that you were either right or wrong. You did a good job or you did a bad job. And a lot of the problem with entrepreneurship education back then was, you know, you write a business plan. And there's, you know, and they say, well, you know, I don't think you can make those numbers. And you say, well, I think I can. And that was pretty much it. And you could never compare yours to anybody else's. Nobody was right or wrong. And so you really didn't learn anything, or this, you couldn't, as a teacher, teach anything. So what we did was we had students create businesses. Not, you know, not all the way, but get out there and put their product in front of customers, put their ideas out there, you know, and then have each of their colleagues essentially invest in the company or not.
Hmm.
And at the end of the quarter, the company would go public, and you would see who made money and who didn't.
You would go through that whole process.
Oh, it was a blast. Yeah.
What an education, too. How has it changed now? That was a while ago, but it's changed today. There's a lot more... I don't know if there's more complexity to the operations or to the sophistication of what we do at UC Davis today, but it's obviously, you know, great things are coming out and businesses are actually coming right out of your guys' programs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I can talk a little bit about that. I think as we think about, Mark, you know this well, right? I mean, entrepreneurship is hands-on, and Andy talked about, you know, sort of doing a spreadsheet and looking at that as a way to judge whether a business is going to be real. And so we've tried to blend the, you know, strength of the academic research that we have at the university with practical hands-on experiences. So as we think about like the way we structure our curriculum, it's a combination of those frameworks that are research tested, bringing folks in that have entrepreneurial experience, that have already been well down their hero's journey as an entrepreneur across different industries, from small to large, and, you know, across different functions. And then the peer interactions. And I think the, you know, we added the peer interactions in the workshops and the hands-on. You know, you've started talking to your prospective customers, and I have as well, right? And like, let's compare notes. How have you learned? Even if we're in different industries, right?
Okay. Like, and are these not necessarily UC Davis students? These are private sector people coming in?
We're talking about our students, but often we will supplement them with, you know, Andy will talk about it in a moment. I'm going to not steal his thunder about the importance of building a network, right? And mm-hmm. So that's when advisors and mentors and people that have more experience than you do come into the fray. But I want to echo something that Andy said, and I saw it when I joined. So my background's industry. I don't have Andy's august research background. I have the school of hard knocks, and yeah, sometimes some soft knocks, but more hard knocks. But this reality of blending that academic rigor and the research-based elements with real-world experiences, what I think our students really benefit from. And so to kind of answer your question about how have things changed, more and more we're getting them to focus on what's the center of starting a business or having an impact. It's the customer, right? So what's the voice of the customer, and how do you engage engage in those conversations early and often and begin to build a true understanding of what's their problem, what's your solution, and how your unique approach may have unique value for them.
And when do you start talking about that, the customer? Because I've seen so many people build products and they've never went out and talked to the users or the customers. I see that all the time in the private sector, not even necessarily out of students. It's from anybody.
So we've gone through a lot of iterations on this, but I think one of the things that we always try and focus on is, you know, there's theory and then there's practice. Mm-hmm. Is how do we get them to practice as quickly as possible? Because when they have that gut feel from practice, then they can start to appreciate the theory better. So one of the things we always do, you know, we have them make a customer call, but we'll do this in a class. So we'll have our entrepreneurship academies they were an answer to the chancellor's request for us to get more students going through these programs, not to keep it into these small, longer fellowships. So we have these 4-day academies where researchers come together. They start to think about how their research could become more impactful. What would it take to get it out there? Is this a business? Is this, you know, is this something that a licensing opportunity? You know, what could this be? And then we have them identify, well, who's it for? Who's the customer? And we'll take one of them and we'll have the entire class brainstorm, okay, we've got 10 questions to ask this customer on a phone call. You know, first one, is this still a good time to talk? Last one, is there anything else I didn't ask that I should know about? So those 8 in the middle, the entire class starts to say, you know, well, what should we ask? And you get, you know, 50 questions that are written down on the board. And then we start to cross off. Yep. Okay. Well, not this one. How about this one? We underline that. And we end up with 8 questions. And then we've arranged already for them to talk to somebody. Like, you know, in one case, we had a surgeon. And the idea was a technology that would allow you to scan an open operating theater, like an open wound where you're resecting a tumor or something, and scan it for tumorous cells. Make sure you didn't leave anything behind. And in the middle of that, in the middle of the description of that offering, that possible technology that they had developed, the surgeon said, absolutely no way. There's no way I'd use that. You know, there's blood everywhere. There's, you know, I don't trust it at all. I wouldn't, you know, there's tumors hide behind tendons or veins. It just makes it impossible for me to trust that I could see it all from my... And it was one of those moments where, in fact, the student who was doing this was grateful because they had worked on this for 1.5 years thinking that this was a great technology, which it was, but not realizing that the person who would use it wouldn't
believe. That's interesting because I've wondered about that in terms of research. You spend 1.5 years on your research. You believe in it. You know, you're not 100% sure. That's why it's research. But and then it gets shot down. I would think that would be demoralizing.
Well, you know, it is if you got the wrong framework.
Okay.
But what he had done was great technology. It was chasing the wrong purpose.
Okay, so
and
might
so
have been
what
able
he learned
to reapply.
Was, okay, that's not where it's going to work. Maybe, you know, can I do it somewhere else? Can I do it in a path lab where it's more accurate, like the pathologist will be able to control the environment better? You know, can I do it somewhere else? It was fantastic technology, but it was clearly not going to go after the surgical market.
Okay.
So, but it's interesting, Mark. I want to build on that if you don't mind.
Yes.
Because I think one of the things, you know, having spent the first half of my career in industry, rarely an industry, like a big company like Disney, rarely you're going to invest in a technology or an approach unless you have a kind of clear vision of how that's going to impact the market, right? In big research universities, a lot of the research that's funded is basic research, right? It's discovery. It's we want knowledge. And it may not have an application or it may not have been funded with an application in mind. And so, you know, to the point that the example that Andy gave, we try to teach our researchers, if you're thinking about a path to commercialization, you know, frankly, no is the second best answer. Yes is obviously the best answer. Maybe is a terrible answer.
Okay.
Right? You know, uncertainty, not being able to know whether should I commit or not commit, that's the problem, right? And you do find people that have been working 3, 5, 7, 9 years on something without ever grappling with, is there a there or not? And, you know, I want to contrast on, you know, in doing general science work and basic knowledge, that's fantastic. And that is a big part of the role of the university. But if your goal is to commercialize, right, is to have impact, to actually have both social and economic impact, you have to be thinking about those questions, as you know, as an entrepreneur, very, very early on.
You bet. You know, I want to ask you, I want to follow up, Joe, with you on the mindset of the student. You were talking about some of them are more interested in just innovation. Others of them might have a business aspiration. They might want to go work for a large company. You know, we all have, some want to be an entrepreneur, right? Yeah. But some are not even knowing what they want to do. And that might have been my daughter. I described her. She didn't know what she was going to do. She got there on a diving scholarship and I got into UC Davis. She was happy and got out in like 3.5 years and ended up getting a job. And ultimately she's a successful realtor now. But there wasn't this, she didn't discover who she wanted to be while she was at UC Davis.
Sure.
So that discovery process, I'm thinking about that as an 18-year-old, as a 20-year-old, 22, or maybe it's in your master's program. When does that breakthrough and discovery of who you want to be
I haven't figured
happen?
It out yet, but I still have a few years left. I'm going to start and then flip it over to Andy. So I have a particular lens I look at this through and that I teach. I'm a big fan of Joseph Campbell and the idea of, you know, a hero of 1,000 faces and a hero's journey. So what we try to talk to our students about is we're all on our own hero's journey. Each is unique, right? Yours and mine are different. They may have some overlap and we may have values that are consistent, but our journey is our own. But as you think about, Annie and I joke about this graphic that I love, and it's a two-part graphic. And the first graphic starts with a little blue, it's actually aqua, circle. Aqua because it's the Dolphins. And I think we can all agree, not so much with the Miami Dolphins.
On the Dolphins.
Right. So, and in the little circle is just the word you. Right? You are here. Right?
Oh,
this
okay.
is you, right? And then the build, the simple build is a whole bunch of other circles, aqua circles with connections, right? And you are your network. And Andy's going to talk about this in more detail in a moment because his research really embodies the importance of networks in driving innovation.
And these networks are people?
Yeah, the idea is the impact that you have on the world, that I have in the world, is based on our ability to build networks, right? Nobody does it alone. But part of building that network early on isn't necessarily I want to go out and change the world, but I want to learn what is my path, right? I want to get exposure to someone who runs a radio podcast, right? Mm-hmm. I want to get exposure or somebody is, you know, doing government work, whatever it is. And so the encouragement, especially for our students earlier in their arc, is go have those experiences. And then for our grad students and PhD students, 80% of them don't end up in academia, right? Yet all the people they've been working with are academics, right? And so we encourage them, and a lot of our programs are giving them exposure to people who do have roles in industry so they can begin to understand, where do I fit in? But the most important thing, in my view, is being mindful of this, right? We all go in our daily, the stuff we have to do, right? So ask them, take a step back and be mindful of where you are now and where you want to go, and have that as a regular part of your process. And if you acknowledge and believe that network is important, we all get 168 hours in a week, right? I don't think you get any more. Scott, you get more than 168?
Scott, he finds more somehow. I don't know how this guy does.
All right.
He does like to work
We need to talk
people.
After this, yeah. my brother, because I need more, right? So we get 168. How are you spending that 168, right? And if you're not spending it on thinking about where you want to go and building your network and evolving yourself, then you're not valuing it, right? Because we all budget, right? Financial budgets, that's an easy thing. But our time is the single most valuable thing that none of us have more of, right? And so how you budget that time, how you spend it, right? If you're not investing in yourself and thinking about your career and building these relationships and trying things out, then, you know, you're not moving forward.
Well, that's interesting because when I think of the UC Davis student, he's different than the, or she is different than the Chico State student. In my mind, I'm stereotyping a little bit, but it's like the brainiacs are over at UC Davis. And what I've seen is being the C student from Oakmont, throwing party guy, it might be easier for a guy like me to build a network than maybe the person that likes to be in the lab coat and, you know, they're super smart and it may be introverted by and large. Is it more difficult to get them to step outside their comfort zone that might be, you know, so now, on the social side?
I'd go right back to what Joe said. You know, this is kind of our mantra, you know, you are your network.
Yeah.
So it's all going to depend on where you want to be. You know, do you want to be running a lab with, you know, 4 PhDs in there and looking for funding for the next biotech revolution? Or do you want to do something else? But if these guys are building their network already, but as Joe points out,
it might be a bunch
their
of
network right now
really
is just the scientists,
smart people,
just
real,
the academics. And then suddenly they have to go and meet investors, or they have to go and find salespeople. They have to go and find, you know, manufacturing. And that's where their network has to change. And but to that point, you know, we don't, everybody's going to be different there.
You bet.
So what we try and focus on is getting them to appreciate that they are their network, and then getting them to appreciate that probably the single most important skill that they're going to have is the ability to grow and adapt that network. And, you know, I mean, talk to any entrepreneur and they'll tell you, you know, hiring and firing is probably the most important thing they do in that company.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Once they've got the product and a, you know, a value proposition, that's great. But if you can't hire the people to deliver it and you can't fire them if they're not delivering it, then that company's not going to go very far, or worse, go south really quick. So how do we teach them the skills of, you know, of thinking about what kinds of skills, you know, what do they need? What experiences do they need? Who's got them and how do they bring them on board?
Well, let's talk about the different innovations that are coming out of UC Davis. We have, you know, life sciences, there's ag tech, there's all kinds of stuff. Are there certain aspects of innovation that are more running more rampant right now out of UC Davis? Because all, you know, I hear about artificial intelligence and how that's affecting all of it.
Well, yeah, I mean, AI is, we're getting the fruits of it now, but the AI is there. I mean, we have strong computer science groups, both in engineering and in the liberal arts. But we also have ag, and we have medicine, and we have you know, veterinary medicine. We have phenomenal graduate programs in all of these, and phenomenal researchers. So, you know, leading ag school in the country, leading vet school in the country. I mean, I don't want to put out anything that other people will quibble with, but we're in, you know, we're constantly either, you know, one or two or three in the world, honestly, for that. Yeah. And the kind of research that's going on there is fantastic. So how does it get out? You know, and for each of these researchers with each of the markets they're going after, it's going to be different.
Yeah. Okay. So did you want to add to that?
Yeah. I just want to add one thing. I think one of the hallmarks of innovation entrepreneurship is being open to being surprised, Mark, right? And so I think in our mind's eye, if you were to ask our undergrads, freshmen coming in, you know, what how would you define an entrepreneur, right? They'd probably give you something that sounds a lot like, you know, Steve Jobs, mm-hmm. right? And which is fine. That's absolutely Steve might, Jobs.
These guys are...
Yeah, all right, fine. Elon Musk,
yeah.
All right, I'm old school, yes. And you know, part of our job is to get them to recognize that if they want to be a change agent and want to have impact, there are many paths, right? And that's a very stereotypical one. And there's nothing wrong with it, but it's not only is it not the only one, it's not the most common one, right? And most of them are going to have jobs in medium to large companies or in government or in NGOs, right? And so thinking, being open-minded about how they can have that impact and where innovation is going to come from is really important. But I'm going to go back to something you said, your comment about some folks are internal, right? And we teach very early on, you can probably tell I'm kind of a lean in sort mm-hmm. of person, right? This is just who I am. And he's probably more lean out, not truly lean out, right? But he says that your goal, right, is to find your comfort zone and just go a little bit further, right? Okay. And be progressive about it, right? You didn't learn how to ride your bike in one afternoon. You didn't learn how to swim in one morning at the pool, right? So if you're going to build your network and you're going to evolve your ability to have impact wherever your area of interest is, it's going to be progressive. But like everything, if you don't start and put effort into it, you're going to not move forward. Yeah.
Sometimes I tell people, you just got to show up. If you're a little shy, don't worry. 100%. I'm a little shy too when it comes down to it, but you show up and the next thing you know, you're meeting somebody that you can connect
right.
with.
And again, you're an entrepreneur, right? And as an entrepreneur, having, you know, been involved, you get no a lot, right? You get no a hell of a lot, whether you're trying to raise money or get a customer, right? You get used to no, right? And so one of the biggest things when we poll the students, but what concerns you about building your network? I'm afraid I'll get rejected. I'm afraid mm-hmm. I'll say no. And I said, so we run a little exercise and we say, so give us an example. We want you to talk. We're going to put you on the spot. Give me an example of when something you really wanted didn't happen, where you got to know. And they talk it through and sometimes it gets a little emotional. And then we all respect that. And we say, and then what happened the next day? It's like, well, I got up and I figured I'm going to do something. It's like, yes. So sun came up, you woke up and you said, I'm resolved to do something new, right? Sometimes it's just this basic idea that what's the downside of no,
right? There's not a lot of downside to no. And in fact, again, you know this, Mark, entrepreneurship is mostly about failing. So John Bissell, one of the founders of Origin Materials, company that came out of UC Davis, right? Doing phenomenal things, right? We have him, Andy and I wrote a case study on him. We teach it in our classes. He comes every year to our class, busy guy, still shows up. He's faithful Aggie. And one of his most powerful statements says, being an entrepreneur is mostly just it's like the, just going up an endless staircase, constantly falling on your face and failing and getting back up and failing again and getting back up. And, you know, it's powerful for the students to hear that from someone who has been very successful, because it looks like, well, he just invented this thing and now he's got this huge company. And it's like, don't see all of those moments of trial and tribulation, and you're going to go through them, but that's okay. So did
I had him on my show probably 7 or 8 years. First year I had the show seven or eight years ago. Yeah. And I made a prediction on the show that John that would be the most impactful entrepreneur in the Sacramento region over the next 100 years. Obviously their company's public now, and you know they're in the process of figuring it out still, but it's got so much potential.
You should have him back.
It's time. Yeah, well, I heard he's going to join the Entrepreneurs Organization. I've been the past president of the Entrepreneurs Organization. Nice. And so that he's a big find for us. And anyway, he's a tremendous asset to our region. And he's speaking at GFX, by the way. We have a big event coming up October 5th. Nice. And he's going to come speak to our audience at GFX as well. So, but thinking about just maybe getting down into the weeds here. So I build a product at UC Davis, I'm a student or I'm a faculty member, and it comes out of UC Davis. Who owns it, and is there something called tech transfer? How does all that work?
So the university system as a whole, the federal government basically at a certain point about 40 years ago now said, in order to incent the universities to help get some of this research out, we're going to give them the opportunity to take a percentage of the revenue from the patents. And so all universities do have, they oversee the submission of the patents, the production of them. They pay for the legal aspects of that. And then they're entitled to a percentage of the patents, usually about 30% of the patent. And then the rest is shared among the inventors and various other parts of the labs that they come from. And so that has been, that's everywhere pretty much across the board. And so if you come out, you've developed some phenomenal technology, unobtainium, it's this incredible material that does everything, and you start to license it to other companies to use, the university has, will be the patent, will
own part of that revenue stream,
and they'll pay you back. What you did on the backs of others that came before you and built that lab or built that field. Yeah. And so it's a certain amount of making sure that the universities.
And do the universities, how does that work? I don't know if John's came out of UC Davis, but comes out of there. Do they own it indefinitely, or do they typically acquire
for the
it
life
back
of the
at
patent,
some point?
That's it.
Oh, for the life of the patent. Okay.
Right. And so really, it's all about licensing these patents. And often what will happen is they'll come out, they'll license the patent, but then one of the hallmarks of almost every science and engineering project that comes out with some promising patents is that, your next 10 improvements on the product will probably, eliminate the need for that original patent.
Oh, gotcha.
Frankly, a lot of the times it's like, we'll keep paying anyway because they're good. And but usually you've left that patent behind by at least the next product rep,
Right.
And so the IP itself is really only an issue primarily at the very beginning, like the university held IP. Whether the university is responsible for negotiating or whether you, the entrepreneur, want to do something with it. And so there's moments of friction there, but otherwise it's honestly a relatively good system.
Okay.
But I think one thing, though, that I think is important to recognize is that most researchers they're not looking around for a research project that can become a business. They're looking around to improve something, an industrial chemical process, an industrial, biological process, medicine. And in a lot of cases, a new business isn't the best way to get it out. The best way is to get a large company who's already in that business to incorporate it into their product.
Right.
And that's where the challenges happen, because some of the times you can patent that and then the universities, you've got now a patent protection and you can go. But other times it's what's in your head. You know, you're a consultant. You know this. You're the leading expert in an industrial chemical transformation process. And there are three firms that, you know, for whom you could make millions, helping them better their process. You go out and consult to them.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a great, honestly, for us, that's a great opportunity. That's a great contribution. You've done great research and you can have a difference. But do you know how to find those companies? Do you know why it's in your interest to try and get involved with them?
Mm-hmm.
And, well, yeah. You know, and do you know that you don't have to quit being a professor? You can do this on, you know, you're allocated some time to do this on your own.
And so yeah, makes sense.
A lot of ways to change the world from their perspective that they don't fully appreciate.
How important is the collaboration within the school, the interdisciplinary collaboration? You might have the different schools that talk to each other, and it's a state government agency. Is there any challenges there, or do you work really seamlessly with one another?
Maybe I better take that, since I'm the less cynical of the two of us on this part, Mark. But Andy will, I'm sure, build on what I said. So I two things. So if you look at research, research is, you know, that the federal government funds is becoming more and more cross-disciplined. So we work a lot with the School of Human Medicine, School of Veterinary Medicine, and the One Health Institute, and a lot of the work being done in them. I mean, we are one planet, right? And, you know, COVID, it was a great example of something that had impact across the whole planet and across all species. So a lot of the basic science research now is already being funded to be, you know, to work across different practices. But if you look at practically in our programs, you're very familiar with the Big Bang. And as you look at our teams over the years, the vast majority of them will have a mix of students from engineering and biological sciences and human and veterinary medicine and the business school and the School of Education, right? Because you have different skill sets that are needed to kind of put it together. And most of the innovations we're seeing require those perspectives to really be successful.
Yeah, we had somebody on the show talk. The Big Bang is for a listener that doesn't know this, Big Bang is a competition done at UC Davis, whereby they take the innovations that are coming out of UC Davis and they have a big pitch competition, and the winner of the Big Bang ended up coming up on our show. And they had built a really neat management team with somebody who was, the finance guy was sitting right there, the sales guy was there, and the product guy, I think, was right here. And I was impressed on how they had come together within the school.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's cool.
And a big part of our job is to create these networking opportunities, right? So Andy's example, you're on the bench, right? And you've been working in some basic science, and all of a sudden you realize, hey, this could have some real application. How do I start, right? And we talk about, without getting too deep in the curriculum, we talk about three different types of validation, right? Technical validation, which our technical researchers understand. How do I, using the empirical method, how do I identify what are my uncertainties, what experiments I need to run, and what data I need to get to address those, right? We also have, as you well know, market uncertainty, right? Will the dogs eat the dog food? Are there customers? How much will they pay? How many will they buy, right? And most of these researchers have discomfort about even thinking about a customer, much less thinking about that model. And then there's business validation, right? Is there an economic model that says there's a go-to-market, a set of relationships, and a strategy that can get your product in the market and make it profitable, make it successful? And this applies even to our students who are thinking about social entrepreneurship, as we teach, even if your motivation is more mission than margin, Mark, at the end of the day, you have to bring in more resources than you expend, or you don't have a sustainable entity, right?
Yeah, I think a lot of people forget about that on these socially responsible business models. Is you want to change the world. We all want to change the world in some way, but, and it's not all about making money, but you still got to drive revenue, right? Even nonprofits need to have, you can't just go get donations for the rest of your life. You've got to have a business model. Is that tough to convert those people from the do good only mentality to, look, do good, but keep it sustainable?
Yeah, I'm not sure that that's the for most of the students that come through, most of the faculty, the research, it isn't about trying to change their minds. It's that they simply don't know that space. They don't know that area. And so, you know, back to Joe's earlier comment, a lot of what we do is say, well, you know, we've got some advisors coming through tonight, you know, people who are going to sit and give you feedback on your ideas. Some of those are from the nonprofits, you know, some of those are, and talk to them and talk to others. And, you know, we'll actually spend a fair amount of time teaching people, how do you reach out to somebody? How do you find out who you want to talk to? How do you reach out to them? How do you pitch yourself as a mentee, as an advisee, trying to get some, you know, grow your network to the point where somebody who already knows how to do that can talk to you?
What's the difference between the ones that make it, you know, the John Bissells of the world? I mean, he's one of a kind, but even the ones that maybe they take it to market and have some success, and the ones that it just gets stuck and sort of falls apart.
I can let you answer that, Andy.
First off, you got to take probably at least half of them off the board for purely technical reasons.
Okay.
You know, probably even more in the sense that this was really promising, but it just doesn't work, economically.
Okay.
And you never really know that till you start to, you know, the scale up that technology to, you know, to a $1 billion corporation scale.
Right.
But usually it's the biggest cause of that kind of is people reaching their own limits of what they thought an entrepreneur would be and what they're learning it needs to be. You know, like I said before, you know, a lot of it is about managing other people, finding the right people, managing them to targets, dealing with them when they don't deliver, you know, because once you've got a second person in, now it's become a social problem, not a technical one.
Yeah. You mentioned nobody does it alone. Yeah. And, it's so true.
Can I build on that just for a second, Mark? So I think there's, you know, there's a whole set of principles, and Andy's research has been so beneficial for this. The way we try to teach it is it's a process, right? It's a progressive process. It's about iteration and collaboration, right? You're not going to get your first business plan, your first technical prototype. It's never going to be right. It's just a degrees of wrong, from somewhat wrong to completely and totally wrong, right? So how do you develop this cycle of iteration and collaboration, right? Bringing the right people in at the right moment and recognize it's going to be constantly iterative. And secondarily is, how do you do it in a progressive way? So Andy talks about, don't do the $500 test or the $500,000 test when you can do the $5 test, right? So don't go spend, you know, $50,000 doing focus groups and deep research when, let's start with a $5 cup of coffee and sit across the table from Mark and go, so, you know, you're running this enterprise. Tell me a little bit about what it's like, because I'm thinking this, right? Mm-hmm. So how do you do that? And I think the students that embrace that progressive process and that iteration and collaboration and importance are the ones that have the best opportunity to ultimately succeed. And then the last piece of this is, again, back to my earlier comment, this is about mostly getting to yes or getting to no. And if you're going to get to no, let's get to know in 3 months, not 3 years, right? And let's get to know with $30,000, not $30 million.
Because many times there's a window of opportunity that we're either going to get tired of it because it didn't work fast enough, or we're going to run out of money, or, you know, different things. I mean, maybe the market need is not there, you know, 3 years from now. Okay, so thinking about Sacramento, the Sacramento entrepreneurial ecosystem, which UC Davis is a key part of, how does UC Davis fit within this ecosystem best? And what else do we need to do within the Sacramento entrepreneurial ecosystem to sort of strengthen up for the benefit of all of us, and including the benefit of UC Davis?
You want me to start? Or you want me?
You give it a go. I'm going to try and...
Again, I have a particular lens on this. So, I think ultimately, and one of the things that I spent a lot of time in Silicon Valley, and I think one of the hallmarks of our region is we are more cooperative than we are competitive. There's always going to be competition, right? But I think that as I think about Cameron Law, who you know well, right? And about our relationship with, you know, with Sac State, and, you know, with the med school and with a lot of the for-profit entities and the funds, it feels cooperative. So it's about, how do we continue to strengthen those relationships in the communication? I think that is a secret sauce we have that, you know, Silicon Valley, which has 100x the capital we have, you know, can't match, right? And then secondarily, I think that if you look at the technical innovations, and I'm defining technical as really the invention, not necessarily high tech, right? A lot of the ag inventions are actually decidedly low tech, and a lot of the food and nutrition stuff, you know, honestly, it's low tech, but it's not technology in the, you know, in the sense of hardware and software. It's about understanding about how, you know, proteins and,
you know, how our bodies operate, for example. And I think that we're not short of those technical innovations. Where we are as a region still in need of more bench strength is in financing, right? In venture, and you know this better than I do, right? And access, ready access. And then bench strength on things like the enabling elements of, you know, if I were working with a startup, so I have a consulting business and we work with a lot of startups. If I'm working with a startup in Silicon Valley and it's clear their CFO, their control, they're at a stage where they need to scale and they need a CFO that's done this before, right? There's 50 people in the Rolodex that I can pick up and one of them is likely to be between jobs or looking for an interim. That's not quite the case here yet, right? At least, you know, for the most part. So the venture side of things and the bench strength in terms of leadership, we're progressing, but we're not quite there yet. And I think that's an area, for me anyway, that needs to continue to evolve. But our secret sauce is our ability to cooperate and work together as a region.
I would agree with what you said. I call Sacramento the place where entrepreneurs can love each other, right? Yeah. This ecosystem... you know, it sounds a little, you know, funny for somebody to say that, but really, if we were to brand our region as something is, you know, collaboration, cooperation, love, helping each other, that's what it's all about. If we can package that as our secret sauce, I think it's actually attractive to the person out of the Silicon Valley that, oh, you know what, I should have moved up here too, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So now Andy's going to tell us why we're both
all right,
wrong,
Andy,
Mark.
Yeah, give me a straight scoop here.
Yeah, my mistake was I opened the political door. There's a lot of politics associated with it. So you know, in regional competitiveness.
Okay.
You know, we would like to be the next Silicon Valley, but honestly, the Silicon Valley was a blip, right? It was it was a moment in time, and I was fortunate enough to kind of grow up in that moment. I was in Palo Alto in the 70s when. Those researchers were developing lasers and developing software and developing, you know, operating systems. And, you know, but before people had started making obscene amounts of money off of it, you know, and this was right in the beginning of the Cohen-Boyer and the, you know, the RNA and DNA swipe. So, and then suddenly the 80s is when a lot of those things became companies. And that was the birth of the venture capital, you know, the popular image of venture capital. It had been around for 20 years, but it hadn't made a whole lot of people a whole lot of money. You know, and by the 90s, you know, the bars in Palo Alto were five people deep on Friday night with a bunch of, you know, of entrepreneurs or you know, people, you know, employees 1 through 50 of any number of startups were all hanging out there. And a lot of them were doing all of the same things. So, you know, the next week you come back and probably half of them have changed jobs by then. And that was a moment. And I don't know that we're going to get back to that moment in those technologies anymore. You know, those are now, I mean, the Intel was a startup. Here, you know, we're a satellite of Intel. You know,
So let's say we want to be the best Sacramento that we can be based upon that. Advice?
I'll tell you, and I guess that's where I was thinking. We have, you know, with UC Davis, what do we have? We have the capital. Of the largest economic, you know, the power, you know, the largest state, you know, in probably whatever the 10th largest country in terms of, you know, fourth largest country in terms of
size of our economy,
GDP.
And stuff.
And then, you know, and we have one of the leading universities that's probably coming back to our earlier conversation, one of the most diverse. As a, you know, we have a med school, we have an ag school, we have a vet school, we have engineering, we have more programs than most universities have. We have more interdisciplinary degrees, which is kind of a signal of the way those programs work across each other. Faculty are constantly working with faculty in other departments, in other fields. You know, we have the opportunity to do something that is going to be very different from what the Silicon Valley did. They built a box, and what you know, these guys are building are seeds, new seeds, but new harvesters, new pickers, new energy policies, and new energy policies in ag, new energy policies in ag around water. You know, so you're going to start to see a whole lot of industries colliding in an area where the policies are going to be profoundly impactful. You know, one of our former students who is a PhD student who came out is now on the California Energy Commission. And he came out of, you know, he came out of our program, he came out of his own PhD program. But what he got as an education was an education
in... When you're talking about policies, you're talking about like state policies, federal government policies?
State policies.
State, okay.
But again, you know, half of the country's energy policy was written by California.
Right.
You
know. And so what you're saying is that as that changes, that could be, we could be opportunistic around that?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, I mean, and not just opportunistic. We can be leader. You know, we can create opportunities.
Leadership. Okay. Interesting.
Well, I want to add something on Andy's point about, you know, cross disciplines, because you know a lot of what we talk with our students is about their interest in addressing the biggest problems of, you know, of our lifetime, right? Climate change, food availability, you know, water, clean water availability, these huge challenging problems. One might even argue threats to democracy. We're not going to get political, but just the reality across the globe, right? Of, you know, in my lifetime, it sort of seems to have waxed and waned in terms of, you know, of governments. And so those huge, you know, wicked problems require a cross-discipline approach to solve, right? And by cross-discipline, I don't mean just, you know, across disciplines in our university, but part of what our university has to do to be effective and have the impact is have relationships outside of the state of California and outside of the United States. And so part of how we do that is be a leading light, right? Mm-hmm. And so if we're, you know, the leading vet school in the world, if we are the leading ag school in the world, right, that brings not just attention and sort of honor to us, which is great, but the ability to organize others to tackle these wicked problems, Mark.
Yeah, well, that's exciting. So what's let's talk maybe last question, two last questions. Like, what's the vision, I guess, for innovation entrepreneurship for UC Davis or the future? And then what else did I not ask you guys today? So it's a two question.
Touche.
I'll start with you, Joe, and then Andy, you can do the mic drop at the end. They have the final answer. So vision, and what else should I have asked you?
Well, so from my standpoint, so don't get me on a soapbox, I'll go for the next 10 minutes. So I'll try to give you a 90-second answer on vision. I think it starts and ends with, you know, our job as educators. And as educators, it's how do we help give our students, wherever they are, and our students are often faculty, but everywhere from that freshman in their first week to faculty member who is a distinguished faculty, how do we give them the tools and the confidence to find their path, to have the impact they want? So it's our job, my vision is to constantly get better and better. We embrace this growth mindset. Like, what are we doing? What's the voice of the customer? How effectively are we doing that? What do we need to continually do? And we're not going to serve all 43,000, you know, students and 10,000 faculty, right? But it's of those that are interested, how are we going to continually help them find their path? We're not going to put them on their path. We're not going to, but we can provide tools and expertise and relationships to get them there. So that's our vision. How do we continue to do that? And not narrowly focused on one type of entrepreneur, anyone who wants to be an innovator, an entrepreneur who wants to have a positive impact.
Love it.
And then, what's your second question?
Did I not ask you? Yeah. Is there anything else that like that we should have covered today that is like part of like a key piece of what you guys do? And I totally brushed over it.
No, I don't think so. I think that I will say one thing, which I think is important, which is I've said it maybe indirectly, and I'll say it directly, which is, entrepreneurship and innovation is for everyone who wants it, right? And so we've shifted our programs early on. It was funded through specific relationships with specific schools. And I think, you know, I want anyone listening to this podcast or thinking about that they want to change the world, that they're welcome, right? And so our programs are now free to everyone. Doesn't matter if we have a relationship with your school, your college, or your ability to pay, none of that matters, right? Everyone can be an innovator and entrepreneur. You got to put in the hard work. Sometimes your idea doesn't work out. We're not guaranteeing that, but we're guaranteeing you can, if you put the energy in, we've got a path to support you and help you.
Very cool. Yeah. Andy, okay, last couple questions here.
Repeat the question.
Vision for UC Davis. Yeah. And I think Joe talked about the student and continuous improvement, which is key.
Fantastic. So with that, I mean, I think Joe and I are on the same page in so much of this, and that's been fantastic. So I think the only thing I can add is, you know, to highlight some of what Joe said, maybe dig a little deeper. There are so many ways to have impact, And, you know, and so defining the entrepreneur is a really important thing we do. And it's not, you know, it's not just who took venture capital or who created, or who owns their own business, or who's, it really is who created an impact, a positive impact in the world around them. And measure it how you want. But like I said, if, you know, if you can become a policy leader, you've got a great opportunity for impact. Mm-hmm. And you've got to be pretty entrepreneurial, even, you know, even more so because you're in a political setting, right?
Yeah.
So you know, let's not take away from that. You know, the same set of skills underlies a lot of anybody who's going out and has a vision and makes that vision a reality. And so we are trying to find the best way to give our students and our faculty, anybody, you know, anybody who goes through our programs, the opportunity to do that. I think, you know, to come back to a statistic, Joe, you put out very quickly earlier, you know, UC Davis produces an enormous number of highly trained researchers. That's, you know, they graduate 8,000 or so doctoral students, you know, I'm sure probably a year. In the sciences and engineering, about 80% of them end up in industry, and they don't get trained for that. So they're trained to do good research, but not to get it all the way to the impact, and to make sure that there's somebody on the other end of that who will pick it up and run with it afterwards. And I think, you know, it's not that we have to teach them how to run their own company. It's that we have to teach them how to get other people involved with what they're doing early enough to get feedback and with enough in it for them to pick it up and run with it further. Mm-hmm. And I think trying to put entrepreneurship in that space where you're not alone, you know, you have to make sure that you're not alone, that
yeah.
you've got others around that you can do what you need to do, and then others you're envisioning who will want what you've got and want to take it forward.
100%, 100%.
And so much of what we're trying to do is that. Now, what are you not asking us that I didn't just try and answer?
Yeah.
You know, it is, I think it's a challenge to teach because most entrepreneurs fail. And financially speaking, most venture capital, 75% of entrepreneurs who are venture capital funded walk away from their startup with $0. 75%. And that's of all VC funded startups that went, you know, that they were acquired or went public. And it's dangerous to teach people that they should all become entrepreneurs mm-hmm. in that fashion. I think one of the things that everybody should be thinking about is how do we properly prepare people to be to have that vision and drive for impact in a safe way.
Yeah.
You know, in a way that allows them to fail safely, as Joe said, you know, fail with the $5 experiment before you fail with the $500,000 experiment. But it's also, how do you train them? What's the best path? So a lot of times we find ourselves encouraging people to know, the average age of a successful entrepreneur, they founded their company at 42 because they took 10 to 15 years to be good in an industry, to become good managers, to build a good Rolodex. You know, that's what made them successful. It wasn't what they had in them at 18.
Right.
It's what they built in, you know, it's what they acquired over the years with the right mindset, the right growth, the right interest and passion. And so how do we train them to be, you know, the most impactful they can be when it doesn't look like, you know, Elon Musk?
Right. There's
and there's no emerald mind in their family. Something like that has got to be something. You know, we sort of have to set the ground rules for how these things have worked before we then sort of encourage them to jump.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate it. You guys are shaping the young minds of the young men and women of our region in such a positive way. It's appreciated. Thanks for coming on the show. Appreciate, you know, everything you do, but also your thoughts around the ecosystem and just how we, you know, the idea that we can get better, and we are getting better, and that should be the vision.
Great. Thanks for having us. Really appreciate
it.
And to all you out there fighting the good fight for entrepreneurship and for the backyard advantage, and of course, all of you out there fighting the good fight for our freedom, our security, and our way of life. Here at Haney Biz, at Mark Haney Show, and the Growth Factory, we're never above you, we're never below you, always by your side.
This segment includes the personal knowledge, experiences, and opinions about angel investing by seasoned angel investors. This content is for informational purposes only and should not be considered as legal, tax, investment, or financial advice. Nothing in the segment constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, or endorsement.